Robert Dalek thinks Lyndon Johnson has gotten an unfair shake. A recent poll showed LBJ as one of the most unpopular presidents in history. And the recent biography by Robert Caro emphasized the former president's underhanded political manipulation. Dalek says there are reasons enough to dislike LBJ, but there exists a hatred that passes the bounds of common sense and contributes nothing to historical understanding. Dalek's new biography of the former president attempts to focus less on the personality of the man and more on his political impact. Dalek has described Johnson as a political visionary. Dalek is a professor of history at UCLA and the author of books about FDR and Ronald Reagan. Dalek's new biography of LBJ follows on the heels of the second volume of Caro's three-part study. I asked Dalek if he wrote his book thinking it would have to answer Caro's.
No, I decided to write on Lyndon Johnson very much on my own. My conviction was that there wasn't a major historical biography being written by a historian. With all that means, namely that the historian going to the documentary record, going to the papers that are available in archives, rather than relying excessively on or very heavily on interviews. But my approach to writing historical biography is to use the contemporary documentary record. I went to the Johnson Library. Mr. Caro did too, of course. But I cast a wider net. I went to the Roosevelt Library and the Truman Library and the Eisenhower Library, the Tommy Corcoran papers in the Library of Congress, the Harold Ickes papers, the Joe and Stuart Alsop papers, the Drew Pearson papers in the Johnson Library. There are collections of materials, the Richard Russell papers, the Hubert Humphrey papers, materials all over this country. They're so abundant. And that, I think, is the first objective of the biographer, not simply to interview, but to get back to the contemporary record and base your work on that record.
Now, why do you think it's better to base your work on somebody's papers rather than on interviews with that person's contemporaries and colleagues?
Because memory is very faulty. You ask someone what happened 20 and 30 years ago, how clear do they have in mind the details of what occurred? Memory has plays tricks on one, and if you have the contemporary record, I think you get much closer to the truth of what happened in someone's life. Now, this is not to say that it's perfect. Obviously, the record can sometimes be doctored. Documents are missing from the record. I think what you want to do is begin with that record and then build upon it by also doing interviews and using oral histories. For example, I used for this book some 350 oral histories, expanding upon what I found in the written contemporary record.
You've described Robert Caro's book as describing Johnson as an unprincipled scoundrel of self-serving, deceitful, power-hungry opportunism. how would you compare your take with Caro's?
Yeah, I like to say that I think I've produced a balanced portrait of Lyndon Johnson. I describe him as a scoundrel, a magnificent scoundrel. I think he can be fairly described as a monster, or what the French call un monstre sacré, a holy monster. I don't pull any punches. I lay out the skullduggery and the machinations and the manipulation. But I also see Johnson as one of the great politicians of the 20th century, and a man with a vision who accomplished some extraordinary things, who thought about the well-being of his region and of his state and of the nation, and that he was a mixed bag. He was a man with mixed motives, and that he was never happier than when his ambition was tied to some larger idealistic goal. I think he's a man rich in contradictions, and I think that's usually the case with a great American politician. Somebody once said of Woodrow Wilson that he was a man of high ideals and no principles. And I think it's a wonderful description to apply to many of our 20th century politicians.
You've described one of Johnson's greatest but most neglected achievements as having brought the South into the mainstream of America. What do you mean by that?
Going back to the 1930s, Johnson believed that if the South were ever going to come into the mainstream of the country's economic and political life, raise its standard of living, have more of a say in the in national politics, it was going to have to take advantage of the federal programs that Franklin Roosevelt and then Harry Truman put into place. It was going to have to take advantage of the federal largesse, the CCC and the WPA and the TVA, the Farm Security Administration, the first federal housing law in 1938. Johnson sees these as an incomparable opportunity to change the economic and political life of the South, and he's one of the most aggressive congressmen and then senators in taking advantage of these government programs. For example, Texas in the 1950 becomes the state with the most air bases in the nation, and that serves his Texas constituents and raises the standard of living in Texas specifically and in the South more generally. Another insight which Johnson had, which has not been well known, is that in order to bring the South into the mainstream of the country's life, it was going to have to overcome segregation. Johnson felt that segregation not only segregated the races in the South, but it segregated the South from the rest of the nation. And as early as the 1930s, I believe, Johnson felt that segregation was destructive to the well-being of his native region. Now, he did not publicly push for civil rights or changes in the Jim Crow system as of the 1930s and 40s and early 50s. He knew that would have been a political death knell for him. But behind the scenes, this man is active in working for the disadvantaged. For example, when he's head of the Texas National Youth Administration in the 1930s, he spends the night at the black colleges. If this were known at the time, it would have barred him from running for any sort of political office. This was an era of strict segregation. He pushes to get the housing legislation, or rather to take advantage of the new housing bill in 1938, which allows Austin, Texas to get some public housing, get money from the federal government to build public housing. And Johnson insists that the city fathers make part of this housing available to blacks and Hispanics. He pushes for black farmers. In fact, one of the principal New Deal administrators of agricultural programs said Johnson raised unshirted hell about the failure of the New Deal to give black farmers in his 10th congressional district equal a share of largesse with the white farmers.
One of the subjects you're going to get into in Volume 2 of your biography of Johnson is the war in Vietnam. And I think one of the questions you'll be examining is, mm-hmm. why did he blow it so badly with the war? Can you give us a preview of some of the conclusions you're going to reach?
Sure, I'm happy to. You're right. This will loom very large in a study of Johnson as president. Seems to me that Johnson's great mistake in dealing with Vietnam was in turning it into Lyndon Johnson's war. You see, I think if Johnson had been wiser about his conduct of that war, he would have allowed a great debate to have gone on in the nation, gone on in the press, in the Congress, as to what the country wanted to do about Vietnam. Did it want to escalate? Did it want to make the sacrifice in the way of blood and treasure that might be required of the country to fight in Vietnam? And I think the answer to that question would have been an emphatic yes in the context of the Cold War in 1963, 64, 65. And if Johnson had allowed this debate to go on, he would have been in a much stronger political position than, in fact, he turned out to be. He could have looked at the war in 1966 and 67 and seen that it was a failing enterprise, and he could have taken Senator Aiken's advice, Senator Aiken of Vermont, who said, "What do you do about Vietnam? You declare victory and leave." Johnson wasn't in that position because he turned it into his war. His ego was so committed to it. He had done it by a kind of stealth, by a kind of indirection. The country, I think, would have been very accepting of withdrawal from that war. After all, what Nixon did during his presidency was to put a fig leaf on American defeat by describing his program as Vietnamization. But shortly after the United States got out, South Vietnam collapsed. Johnson could have done the same thing because I think by 67, certainly, the country was fed up with the war and would have been ready to leave. And so, in a sense, the imperial presidency destroyed Johnson's presidency. His failure to deal more effectively with the politics of foreign policy is what undercut his presidency and destroyed his leadership.
Robert Dalek is the author of the new biography of Lyndon Johnson called Lone Star Rising. A second volume is in the works. This is Fresh Air.